President Trump record his conversations with former FBI Director Comey?
I assume you're referring to the tweet, and I've talked to the president. The president has nothing further to add on that.
Why did he say that? Why did he tweet that? What should we interpret from that?
As I mentioned, the president has nothing further to add on that.
Are there recording devices in the Oval Office or in the residence?
As I said for the third time, there is nothing further to add on that.
Does he think it's appropriate to threaten someone like Mr. Comey not to speak?
I don't think that's not a threat. He's simply stated a fact. The tweet speaks for itself. I'm moving on.
Well, the White House press briefing has become essential viewing. That was spokesman Sean Spicer, of course, back in action again today. He was responding to a question about this tweet President Trump sent out this morning. James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. Jonathan Weissman is deputy Washington editor for The New York Times. Hi there.
Hi. How
well,
are you?
I'm well, thank you very much. So, as we heard, Sean Spicer didn't have a lot to say about this tweet. And is there any reason to believe that the phone call between Comey and the president might have been recorded?
Well, you know, obviously we have seen recordings of the goings on in the Oval Office from Nixon to Johnson and on and on and on. So, you know, it is certainly not without precedent to have recording devices, not on phone calls, however. And I think what's really extraordinary isn't necessarily whether there really was a tape, but that the president of the United States issued what looked like a very not very veiled threat to the FBI director that he has just fired against leaking or else.
Yeah. And so could there be any legal issues brought up by that? In other words, could that be described as possible witness intimidation or obstruction of justice?
I would say obstruction of justice. Yes. I mean, look, if you're trying to build a case that President Trump is trying to interfere with the investigation of possible ties or collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, you know, it does not help the president's case to try to intimidate a potential witness. And this looks like intimidation, and certainly that could be part of an obstruction of justice case.
Right. And so now Democrats are calling for tapes to be handed over, if indeed there are tapes. Adam Schiff, he's the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, saying that and also pointing out that this is extraordinary given the fact that Donald Trump complained about wiretapping that did not exist by former President Barack Obama.
Right. And remember, now, once again, like he fell back on this defense on the wiretap case where he said that those were in quotes, so he maybe wasn't serious. This time he also put the no tapes. When he said James Comey, better hope that there are no tapes, he put tapes in quotation marks there too. So, you know, it is so hard to figure out what to take seriously and what not to take seriously. I think that if there was, regardless of whether there are tapes or not, there seemed to be an implication of intimidation. But gosh, who knows if there actually were any tapes?
Yeah. And so the story keeps going, whereas perhaps it, you know, in normal circumstances, these scandals tend to have a shelf life of a couple of days or so, but it just keeps going.
That is what's remarkable, how good President Trump is in keeping these things going.
Well, you have to wonder, is he doing that on purpose for some other reason?
It's hard to divine these things, really, but I've got to think that this is not helping him whatsoever. When he fired Comey, it was a Tuesday night. It felt like the world was going to come to an end, right? There was a lot of hair on fire in Washington that Tuesday night going into Wednesday. By Wednesday afternoon, you started to feel like, well, you know, he was in his right. A president is allowed to fire the FBI director, and maybe it would pass over. But it didn't pass over, and it didn't pass over because the president himself kept contradicting the assertions of his people and his FBI and his Justice Department.
And then he tweeted about that as well. He said, well, this is a busy White House. They can't be expected to get everything right. Maybe I should just cancel press briefings altogether.
Exactly. You know, in fact, when he tweeted out that this morning, I thought that was going to be the story of the day. I mean, basically, he was saying, hey, you can't trust what Sean Spicer or Sarah Huckabee Sanders is saying at the podium. They might be right, they might be wrong, but, you know, don't worry about it. I thought that was going to be the huge story of the day, but then he just kept going. This is kind of his modus operandi.
Also, your paper reporting that two associates of James Comey, he told them that the president had insisted that he signal loyalty to him, that he pledge loyalty to the president, and that Comey demurred. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary dinner. It was in January, in the early days of the Trump White House. The president invited James Comey to the White House for dinner. They made small talk, talked about the usual things that Trump loves to talk about, his crowd size and his inauguration and such. And then, according to our sources, President Trump turned to Comey and said, "Do I have your loyalty?" And Comey responded, "Sir, you have my honesty." And then he came back and he said, "Sir, do I have your loyalty?" And he said, "Sir, you have my honesty." And he kept coming out, and finally he said, "Do I have your honest loyalty?" And I think ultimately Comey decided he could live with that, his honest loyalty or his loyal honesty or something, mm-hmm. Some such. But no, he according to our sources, and we trust them very much, the president pressed the FBI director to swear loyalty, which is remarkable because this is the reason that FBI directors have 10-year terms is that their loyalty is supposed to be to the law and to the investigations and their own integrity, and it is not to be to the president of the United States who happens to be in office at that moment.
And something else that Sean Spicer had to clear up today when he was asked about it.
He swears it never happened, but we stand by the story.
Well, you know, this could be just a basic misunderstanding on the president's part. I mean, he hasn't been in public service. He's never been in government office. He doesn't maybe know what the rules are when it comes to being a director of the FBI. Could it be chalked up to that, or is this something else?
You know, look, it absolutely could be chalked up to that. President Trump has shown many times that he doesn't really understand the intricacies of the federal government. He didn't run as somebody who understood the intricacies of government. He ran to drain the swamp, right? So he doesn't follow the niceties of Washington. And does he know that the FBI director serves a 10-year term to avoid politics? He very well might not have. He was in the middle at that time of dismissing a lot of Obama administration holdovers and trying to fill his cabinet and his agencies with loyalists. So, yeah, he may well have thought that the FBI director was supposed to be loyal to him.
All right. Well, it continues. We'll see what's next. Can't wait.
Absolutely.
Jonathan Weissman, Deputy Washington Editor for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Washington politics are in an uproar, but we've got our own little pot of political crazy stew that's been cooking here in Los Angeles. In City Council District 1, that includes Highland Park, Eagle Rock, and Pico Union, bike shop owner Joe Bray Ali is challenging incumbent Gil Cedillo. Bray Ali's campaign has been in turmoil since it came out that he made racist and other offensive comments online. He followed that up with a Facebook post in which he said he owes a lot of money in back taxes and that he cheated on his wife. Gil Cedillo spoke with us earlier this week. Joe Bray Ali is here now in studio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, on Tuesday, we asked Cedillo why the LA Times initially endorsed you, and here is what he said.
He impressed them with the things he said, but all they had to do was challenge him, you know, just go a little one inch deeper, and they would find that he was not all the things that he said he was. And they found that out, much to their embarrassment, much to their chagrin, and have abandoned him, as everybody, as his hedge funder from New York has abandoned him, as Mitchell Farrell has abandoned him, as the environmental community has abandoned him, because they found him to be a charlatan, a fraud.
Okay, so as the councilman says, you have lost a lot of support since those comments came out. Veterans groups say you should pull out for advocating burning the American flag, for example. But you've said that you've made mistakes and that you've changed. And what? So tell us about that and why voters should trust you.
You know, you open this statement as the LA Times opened their sloppy coverage of a blog post in LAist with the allegations that I personally made racist comments, that I am all these nasty things. The reality is that I did not make the forum that I visited. I did not write the headlines. I did engage with people that were not nice people online. It's not the most polite thing to do with yourself, but that I myself am not a racist. The statements I made were not racist and were not transphobic, perhaps ignorant, perhaps done in a flash of negative emotion in one instance or another, but do not reflect the headlines and the news coverage, do not reflect who I am. They do not reflect what I said, and frankly, don't reflect what I believe. The big question that I've found for my supporters is, what were you doing there in the first place? What were you doing in these forums? And, you know, are you a good person?
You yourself said in your own Facebook posting, my offensive and profane comments online.
Mm-hmm.
You called them offensive and profane yourself.
To class all of my comments in a big ball of 15 years of living a very open life online, there has been a targeted character assassination campaign and a willing partner in the local media to take a blogger's headline and misinterpret it. What I've really learned and how I've really changed is that I am much more prepared for personal attacks now. It was something I was not prepared for when
this news came out. But are you saying that you didn't make the comments you made about women fighting and talking about pulling a woman's weave off, or the comments that you made about transgender people and the surgery being unnecessary, the comments you made about fat people online there? Are you saying that those were all
It sounds like you've actually read the comment, which is something that 99% of the people that heard about this didn't. And it was a willful mischaracterization of what I said. And I've had to move beyond it. And I think my campaign has clearly moved beyond it, because there are issues in this race that are much more important than personality politics and the identity politics of the old Los Angeles, which was one group versus another. And now this national narrative of, are you allowed to even participate in certain types of speech at all? I obviously take a radically different position than a lot of people do, which is, I think that it's okay for people to seek out really offensive things. That's what I've done my whole life. And it's a part of the city that I live in.
One of those forums had the N-word in it. The title of it was, and I'm not going to say it online, but it is the N-word. Why would you be on something like that?
I seek out the opinions of people I 100% disagree with.
So do you still visit that site?
I don't have time to visit that website. I am focusing on running a political campaign. I don't have downtime anymore to go and explore the dark side of the internet.
Okay. You also admitted to not paying your taxes, $48,000, not an insignificant
amount.
It's
a business tax that is owed to the State Board of Equalization for an LLC that I'm a member of. It's a debt that will be paid, and it was the result of an audit. I wasn't really sure how to deal with that debt at that time, and so I was too scared and embarrassed to deal with it. I'll have to pay it off. It's just going to have to get worked out. The reason why I made those statements on my Facebook page was that I knew that the other side in this political race was going to bring them up in a matter of days. The political blackmail was something that I just was not prepared to. I wanted to get beyond it. And if there are questions about my character and personality, I feel like there's been an unequal focus on those in the last 2 weeks. The incumbent council member has an open investigation into a real criminal money laundering scheme with Sammy Leung at the Seabreeze development in San Pedro. He has real implications and numerous pay-to-play political favors being done for the developer Jeffrey Palmer. And these are kind of run-of-the-mill scandals in LA politics. And I know the personality and identity politics that have entered this race have made it exciting for the media. But frankly, I'm in this position because people are sick of petty, large-scale, what appears to be city hall corruption when it comes to land use decisions. I'm here because we have been ignored as a district for the last 4 years. Crime has gone up. Homelessness has gone up. Evictions have gone up. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And if the management team that got you here has nothing better to say than the other guy running is a bad dude, I don't trust that person saying that. There's much more to this than simply 2 weeks before the election, people winging it in from left field with all these accusations about my character and who I am.
But you can't dispute that character is a measure of a man, that many voters look to see what kind of person is going to represent the city of Los Angeles. And they want someone who is not going to make offensive comments or believe in something that they don't believe in, something that may be described as discriminatory. So you can't fault voters for wanting to know more about what you really believe in.
You know, they've taken a small shard of my life online and have written off the policy analysis. They've written off the time I built a community co-op, which is a radically inclusive space for people to go, in this instance, to fix their bikes. But it was, from the beginning, founded with, by, and for people from across the demographic and economic spectrum in my neighborhood. From the beginning of my life to this current day, I have been about radical inclusion of all voices and everybody's perspective. That's who I am and what I've done for the last 12 years. One small shard 2 weeks before the election that says, you're a bad guy. May 17th, is anyone really going to care about any of this personality politics? No, they're going to want to know if their street's going to get cleaned, if their neighborhood park bathrooms are going to be repaired. And that is what I have run on. And that is where I have beaten the incumbent time and time again. That's what people are concerned
about.
But
the endorsements aren't there anymore. And so do you think that that is... Do you think that's the fault of the endorsers, or do you bear some responsibility for that?
My personal faults being what they are, I prepared quite a nice grassroots campaign. We've got outspent 5-1, 6-1, if you include his Chevron money in that independent expenditure. But what we have operationally been able to do is to fight back in the door-to-door campaign, the phone banking, the email, the text messaging, the tweet, Twitter, Facebook. But what we really failed was on the opposition research. I did not pay any attention to all of the slanderous things that were fed to me from people that do not like the incumbent. I did not turn them into hit pieces. I did not make attack mail. And I did not prepare for inbound personality assassination.
This is all coming from him?
It's either coming from him or his surrogates. This so-called veterans group, headed by a man named Mr. Quiroz, whose wife filed a false police report against my own brother at a forum. It's been an insane turmoil in my personal life, filing for office. And there's a reason why I have a deep respect for anyone that would go through at this point.
Your dad's a political consultant, right?
My father worked for a number of years in politics in Sacramento. He helped build the Latino Coalition.
So you're no stranger to politics is what I'm trying to say. It's not like you don't know anything about it.
I wouldn't get to this point if I didn't know anything about it.
So but, you know that it can be rough and tumble.
I know it can be rough and tumble, but I think came at it a bit too idealistically. I focus too much on my policy research. I focus too much on listening to neighbors. I guess that would be my fault. I focus too much on running a positive campaign. That's going to be something that I'm going to have to live with.
You were featured in a documentary about a group of cyclists in East LA, a women's bike group. It's called Ovarian Psychos. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes.
Many of those women have gone through trauma. And there is a clip of you in that movie.
Well, there are probably people that could better handle the women's issue discussion than the Ovarians, because they have like little, tends to be kind of violent. She acted violent towards this woman I was meeting for the first time, and drank my beer and got in my face the way a guy would to start a fight.
Okay, you're a cyclist, a bike activist. What is your problem with these women, these cyclists?
My problem. What I learned from that movie is something that didn't come across in my personal interactions with the women that are members of the Ovarian Psychos. What came across in my personal interactions with them was, at first, it was incredibly encouraging. I tried to help them in any way I could to grow their group and do what they needed to do. Months or a year after I first met some of the women that started the group, there were a number of violent interactions between individual members of that group and people that I was acquainted with that made me question, wow, what's going on here? That movie answered the questions I had. The Ovarian Psychos, they really did a great job communicating the message that, yes, we do have something to say about civil rights, and riding a bike is something to do with our basic human rights. I really had to recognize that I maybe sold the whole thing short. You know, I'd like to support them in any way I can, although at this point, I mean, I've had to take a month off after this election and become a little bit more of a regular person again.
Are you saying that you don't expect to win on Tuesday?
I expect it to be a very closely fought race. And so whatever happens, I'll have a little bit of downtime.
But what are you going to do if you don't win?
Take my dog for a walk. She's losing her mind.
I mean, in the long term.
In the long term, if I don't win, I'm going to keep on doing whatever I can to feel like my work matters to other people and the lives of other people.
Why should someone vote for you? What would you bring to them, someone in your district?
Someone who cares about this district deeply, fundamentally, and profoundly, who will take the time to listen to their needs and their concerns, and integrate them into an effective city policy.
Joe Braille, running for City Council District 1. The election is on Tuesday. Thank you for coming in today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Here's what air travel is sounding like these days.
The bizarre and disturbing moment caught on camera aboard a United Airlines flight.
There you go. Hey,
busted his lip.
Oh, my God. Look at what you did to him.
Passengers erupted in anger after Spirit Airlines canceled 9 flights.
The question is, how did it get to this point?
Wow. But if you're one of the lucky and wealthy few elite flyers at LAX's new private suite, it might sound more like this.
Journey to a serene oasis where unspoiled beauty and nurturing therapies inspire a renewed sense of harmony.
For the price of $7,500 a year, plus a couple extra thou per flight, well-heeled flyers get private TSA security lines, a full bar, and a chauffeured BMW directly to your airplane. Steve Lopez got a sneak peek at the private suite and was kind enough to put down his champagne flute and join us. Hi.
Hey, how are you? Are you signed up yet? I'm in on this. This sounds fabulous.
Okay, what is the total cost? Because maybe I am in.
Well, that was the deal breaker for me. It's $7,500 to become a member of the private suite at LAX. Just to become a member, and guess what? That's not a lifetime membership. You got to pay that every year. And, you know, if you travel once or twice, that's pretty steep. If you travel, I don't know, 20, 30 times, maybe it comes in handy. But you got to pay $7,500 up front, and then you got to pay like $2,700 for a domestic flight. I think it's $3,000 for international. You can bring 3 other people with you. That's good for 4 people.
Well, that's nice. That's a bargain maybe for some people. I don't know. So you're not only paying the $7,500 every year, you're paying a couple grand every time you fly. So
that's right. Okay. That's right. And it's for what? Maybe a couple of hours of convenience. You get around all of the traffic going into LAX because, oh, by the way, this approach, it's not the approach that we mere mortals take to get to our flights at LAX where you get on that horseshoe and try to squeeze in between.
Yeah, and God forbid you miss your terminal and you're...
Right.
Got to do it all over again.
No, this is, you skip that. You take the 105 past that Sepulveda exit where everybody's backed up. You go down like you're going to Manhattan Beach there, and then on the right in that cargo area, there they are. You drive through a big gate. There's a guy, there's an armed guard. I mean, this guy looks like he is equipped to defend that place. They open these great big doors, these fortress walls. You go in, and it's like a club. I mean, it's very modern, and you pull up, and there's a concierge to, you know, take your bags and escort you to your suite, your lovely private suite, where you can munch on the hors d'oeuvres, the snacks, the liquor, whatever you want to do. And then they whisk you through your own personal TSA check-in and, you know, security and all of that. Then you get into a BMW and you're out on the tarmac there being whisked across the grounds to your plane.
One of the key details I read in an article on this is an iPad that sits on a counter at the entrance with a typed little note that says, here's a glimpse of what you're missing over at the main terminal right now. And it's a video feed of the chaos at in the regular main terminal. It sounds like the Hunger Games.
You know what? I didn't see that when I was there, but I was given sort of a pre-tour to get the flavor of it. If that's there, though, if that what you just described is there, that's all the more evil. But it's perfect. I think this is all perfect for Los Angeles, isn't it? I mean, come on. We didn't have enough division between the 1% and the rest of us. And I don't know that I can't say that I'm shocked. I'm not surprised. I'm not even that angry. I mean, I wrote about a couple who bought a $30 million house in mint condition in Beverly Hills and tore it down because they didn't like the kitchen. I mean, I wrote about somebody in Bel Air who used as much water in a day as we had spilling out of the Oroville Dam. This is the land of excess, and it's not just celebrities. We got so many moguls and wealthy executives, and they don't want to deal with, you know, the hassle of getting into the airport. So this is This is their way around it.
So is this costing taxpayers anything? You mentioned that they're getting their own private TSA screening.
Yeah, you know, that's what I zeroed in on when I had my interview with Gavin DeBecker, who is the guy behind this whole thing. He's made a career of security and service for high rollers. And I thought, when I first heard, okay, they're going to have TSA people, I thought, all right, so you're standing in a line a mile long at the main terminal, and there aren't enough TSA people to process everybody, so it's going to take you forever, and you might miss your flight. And meanwhile, a TSA employee or two, along with the border protection employees, are over there servicing the elite, the high rollers. And I thought that's just not fair. And I think it's not fair. But what they said is that those TSA employees at LAX and elsewhere often are servicing private operations, and that their other argument was, this takes the load off. There's not any big commotion around a celebrity sighting. And then the other thing is, they can't do this for free at LAX. They have to pay these licensing and other fees, and it adds up to something like, I think it's $34 million that LA World Airports gets over the course of 10 years. And they're saying, we're going to spend that money on relieving congestion and making the whole process a little easier for the hoi polloi, for the rest of you. Poor.
So that's supposed to make us like it? That we get the crumbs, the $35 million in crumbs.
It doesn't sound like it's working on you. You're still not liking it, are you?
That's because I'm not a part of it. As soon as I get in there, I'll be like, yeah, I like this. This is great.
Well, hey, guess what? If you think you want to try it, you don't have to become a member for $7,500. You can do this as a non-member. And then the price is a little steeper. I think it's like $3,000. But you can still do this. Let's say you hit a jackpot, you hit a lottery, and you're thinking, I'm traveling. And I want to go the easy. I want to take the easy way this time. You can do it. You don't have to be a member. So for $3,000, you can save maybe 40 minutes if you think that's worth it.
Well, maybe it will be eventually. Here's the other thing I think that is interesting is that they're trying to make this sound good for us by saying there will be fewer paparazzi in the main terminal bugging the rest of us because the stars won't be there. They'll be in this private suite.
Yeah, well, here's my question about that. I should have emphasized this in the column. I don't recall, I've gone to LAX a lot, I don't recall ever seeing a paparazzi. So I'm not even sure I can believe any of that. I mean, have you ever had your entrance delayed because paparazzi were going after, you know, George Costanza or something? I'm not buying it.
Wait a minute. You're the paparazzi. I'm the paparazzi. We're our own paparazzi, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. But I think, yes, some of the justification for it is a bit of a stretch. Well, they should just come out and say, look, there's a hell of a lot of money in this town, and people have so much they don't know what to do with it. Here's another way for them to spend it. That's what this is.
Steve Lopez. He is the coach flyer columnist for the LA Times. Thanks so much, Steve.
Yeah, and I'm running out of leg room, too.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. You know Wallace Shawn. Even if you don't think you do, you do. My Dinner with Andre, Toy Story, The Princess Bride.
You guessed wrong.
You only think I guessed wrong. That's what's so funny. I switched glasses when your back was turned. Ha ha, you fool. You fell victim to one of the classic blunders. The most famous is never get involved in a land war in Asia. But only slightly less well known is this. Never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
An instantly recognizable face and voice. Well, Wallace Shawn, you may also know or not, no judgment, also writes plays. And his play, The Designated Mourner, is enjoying a 2-week run at the Red Cat downtown.
I have to tell you that a very special little world has died. And I am the designated mourner.
That's Wallace Shawn playing Jack. There are just two other actors in the play, Shawn's onstage wife and real-life partner, Deborah Eisenberg, and Larry Pine, who plays her father, a poet and intellectual. Despite grave threats, those two characters hang on to the world of books and high culture in a country being overtaken by a wave of totalitarianism. Jack does not.
Pardon me. But shouldn't there be some distinction drawn between the things we say, the lies, the "I like poetry, I like Rembrandt" on the one hand? And I mean, of course it's important to say those things, because after all, if you don't say them, you become simply a zoo animal. But still, they're lies. They are lies.
Wallace Shawn came by our studios to talk about The Designated Mourner, the play's resonance in our current world, and how his character, Jack, changes.
He becomes a real anti-intellectual, the guy I play. And he is very, very angry at the father-in-law, whom he would see as the elite. Mm. The way Trump feels about people who seem to be smarter than him or know more, tremendous resentment. That's how my character, Jack, feels about his father-in-law and in a way about his wife. He doesn't start off really as an anti-intellectual. He starts off really prepared to be a student, a disciple, to learn from them. But as the play develops, the situation in the country gets nastier, and the father-in-law, as a kind of very quiet dissident who really just writes poetry, but who at one time made his sympathy for the poor well known, is under threat. And so my character realizes that hanging out with his wife and his father-in-law is very dangerous.
So your character is a survivor.
He is.
And he sees that he needs to distance himself from his wife and his father-in-law in order to survive. Are we supposed to, or at least keep our minds open to, having sympathy for your character?
Well, I'm trying very hard as an actor, and I did try as a writer to win the audience completely over to my side and convince them that my point of view is the one they should adopt. I've set up a little game for the audience that's reasonably challenging. But yes, I try to present the best possible case for myself. I mean, most people are not heroic, and most people do try to survive, and only a handful of people take risks. In the case of this play, the risks are extremely serious ones.
And do you think that most people in the audience come, and because I imagine that most people who would come to see this play or are interested in your work would be people who consider themselves intellectual, or at least interested in intellectual pursuits, and would identify with Judy and her dad than with your character, but then secretly harbor what the desires that your character brings to light, that they like to watch screens, and they like to watch porn, and they like to eat chocolate and indulge in the, you know, the quotidian.
Yeah, I think that it does. For some people, that there would be, they would experience some dissonance as they watch the play, because I'm trying to sell the idea, really, that even though I admit, as Jack, I admit that at one point I tried to read more difficult books and poetry and the books that my father-in-law read. By the time the play gets rolling, I'm really trying to convince the audience that anybody who says they like those things is a fraud and a phony and doesn't really like them. And as you say, just really prefers
whatever you just said, pornography, television, and chocolate.
Well, can you like both equally?
Well, that's an interesting question. Very few people really do like both in a funny way. I think there is a bit of a conflict, although it's an interesting question. In the play, Jack says basically that's the real me likes the trash, and the fake me likes the better things. And I think many of us really believe that, and we've been convinced to believe it. It actually is not true that that has to be a human being's deepest level, but most of us believe that it is.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Wallace Shawn. He's the playwright who wrote The Designated Mourner. He also stars in it. It's up at the Red Cat right now. And, of course, it isn't just that your character, Jack, likes trash. It's that is dangerous is what happens in the play, is that this adherence and obsession with trash and rejection of intellectualism and high culture is actually mortally dangerous for those who are in the business of intellectualism or in the business of culture. So it isn't just a fun parlor game of whether you prefer porn to poetry. It's actually a matter of life and death.
In the play, it is a matter of life and death.
So what do you think it is for us in real life?
Well, I think of the play as being pretty close to real life. The topics are obviously pretty hot topics. Really, I mean, people will react how they react. I don't really know how they'll react. They'll react differently from the way an audience would have, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
Oh, you think? Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Why do you think that?
Well, I know that from experience, that when we first did the play in the year 2000, that was before the attacks on the World Trade Center, a lot of people said, well, what does the political violence symbolize? I said, it symbolizes itself. What do you mean? And when Jack, my character, speaks about the fact that most of the people in the world don't like us, people didn't seem to react. Whereas when we did it after the destruction of the World Trade Center, people fell into remarkable silence when I started talking about that. And I think by now it's so well known that it may seem like, why is he saying things that are so obvious?
Hmm.
I mean, that's kind of the interest of theater. It keeps changing, you know. Different people see it differently, and it looks different at different historical moments.
Do you think that more people now see themselves in the Jack character than they did 10, 15 years ago?
That I won't, I don't know. I mean, I think Jack has a bunch of characteristics, but certainly the rage that he feels against the people who he feels look down on him because he's not smart enough and because he's not serious enough, that attitude obviously is Trump's attitude, and many of the people who love Trump clearly found it inspiring. And I think Trump's hatred of what he sees as an elite motivates a great deal of his behavior. A lot of what he does is calculated to enrage, you know, a very small group of people who go to the ballet and read the New York Review of Books. Those people, I think, must have had a big impact on him on some terrible day in high school, and he's never gotten over it.
Wallace Shawn, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
That's Wallace Shawn. He wrote and stars in the play, The Designated Mourner. It's running at the Red Cat at the Disney Concert Hall through Sunday, May 21st. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. Finally, that means we can take a little break from the news and talk about movies. Whitney Seibold is here. He contributes to Crave Online. Hi there.
Hello.
First up, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, directed by Guy Ritchie and starring Charlie Hunnam of Sons of Anarchy fame. Here's a clip.
I woke up.
From where?
From a nightmare.
What was it about? Then?
Then, me and the lads took care of a bit of business.
Hold up, back up. You've left something out.
Are you writing a book? They all lived happily ever after.
No, they didn't know that.
Okay, this looks like it could be a cool Guy Ritchie flick. Is it?
Well, cool is not something this film is lacking. Sense is something it is, however. That clip you just played, it sounds like a preview, something that was cut very, very quickly. However, that was taken wholesale from the film itself.
Oh.
There are really fast, very trailer-like montages to sort of illustrate all of the action throughout. So unless you're prepared to sort of sit down and take that sort of breakneck pace, then you're going to be a little bit...
One review said there's a lot of mouth breathing in this movie.
A lot of mouth breathing, a lot of intense close-ups of people sort of leaning in and breathing very heavily. The most distressing thing is the way it casts King Arthur himself. It's been a little while since we've had a Knights of the Round Table feature film. I think 2005 might have been the last instance. In that one, Keira Knightley played Guinevere as sort of a half-naked, leather-clad, bow-and-arrow-wielding warrioress. Okay. This time around, we have King Arthur, played by Charlie Hunnam, and he and his merry men, Knights of the Round Table, are seen as sort of street toughs. They're all raised in and about brothels. They're all very street smart. They kind of pound their chests and talk about drinking beer. They're like the cast of Entourage in a lot of ways. But it's King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, so any sort of thoughts of chivalry and knight-errantry, that is far, far away from this film.
Really, there are no heroes. No swashbuckling heroes that are going to right wrongs and kill dragons?
Buckles can no longer be swashed in modern feature films, unfortunately. Everything has to be dark and hazy. So, yeah, we have a lagerlout King Arthur and a bad guy who has been sacrificing loved ones to some subterranean squid monster women in exchange for superpowers. It's more or less a superhero movie. That's all we have. Guy Ritchie's one attempt at political commentary might be that the bad guy played by Jude Law is trying to build his very own Trump Tower, and their goal is to stop him from building this tower.
Trump Tower?
It's not called Trump Tower, but it is a large tower that he is intent on building. That's his one motivation.
Okay. So
everything is very shallow. Everything is very rich and flip and kind of energetic. It moves at a breakneck pace like most Guy Ritchie films.
Is it fun at all?
Here's the thing about Guy Ritchie films. They're fun in the moment. They're fun while you're watching them. You're kind of interested in this sort of fast pace and you can understand what's going on from scene to scene. As soon as the film is over, it's kind of gone from your head. You don't really care. The only thing you really take with you is a few cute references to classical literature. The final scene of the movie is the invention of the Round Table. That's not a spoiler. This is the Knights of the Round Table. And it's never really explained the significance of this table or why it's being built. It's just described as, and this is a quote of a line of dialogue from the film, it's a table, you sit at it. That's about as intelligent as King Arthur is.
That's pretty much where we are in our culture at this point. Okay, let's move on to Snatched. This is a mother-daughter buddies in trouble movie starring Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn.
Let's go out tonight.
Hair, makeup, boobs, we're going out.
Emily, I am not going out at night.
Everything shouldn't be so scary.
Oh, it damn well should. 1 in 4 tourists are kidnapped.
Not true.
1, 2, 3, somebody's missing.
What is this movie about?
Goldie Hawn is the doting mother of Amy Schumer. They talk frequently, and yet Goldie Hawn is annoying in that movie parent sort of way. She is afraid of the world. She doesn't go out. She's very shy, whereas Amy Schumer is essentially playing Amy Schumer. They decide to go on a South American vacation. Amy Schumer meets a handsome young man who shows intense interest in her. They go on a day trip together. Lo and behold, he's a kidnapper, and they find themselves in the hands of kidnappers. And they must use their wherewithal, what little they have, to find their way back to civilization. Hijinks ostensibly ensue. However, the film picks up no real energy, and the chemistry between Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn is surprisingly lacking. Amy Schumer is hilarious. I've seen her, some of her stand-up. I've seen her in other movies, and she has a definite kind of filthy appeal. She knows how to just cut through all of the treacle and do something really straightforward. Goldie Hawn, of course, is a legend. She hasn't been in a film for about 15 years, and I think Amy Schumer convinced her to come back for this one.
And comedian in her own right.
A great comedian in her own right. She plays a character who used to be interesting and now is afraid, and yet that's not ever really explored. In fact, the true nature of their relationship is never really explored, except in a few bland Hollywood platitudes about having more fun and being more interesting and spending more time together.
So what about this idea of two white blonde ladies being kidnapped by a bunch of dark-skinned bad guys?
Well, that is sort of a problem, isn't it? Hollywood kind of takes for granted that this is just sort of something ordinary white suburban people are going to be afraid of. So all of the dark-skinned Latino characters are vilified throughout the film. They're played for laughs. They're played as monsters. It's kind of offensive. It's almost unfortunate that I have to think about that to bring it up, because it's so common in so many Hollywood films. This is yet another instance of it. I'm unsure as to why Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn, two very popular people, would gather together to make something this bland and so much of a throwback to earlier types of movies.
Yeah.
You would think they would try to break something. They tried to do something kind of daring. They tried to do something at least edgy. The R-rated material just sort of lays there. There's a few F-bombs dropped and you hardly even notice.
So there's
some violence, but it's not terribly violent. I chuckled twice. I'm not sure how much that counts, though. Being genial and being affable doesn't quite count as being a great comedy. It's ultimately kind of like King Arthur, pretty forgettable.
Well, speaking of funny ladies, I hear Melissa McCarthy is back on Saturday Night Live this weekend playing Sean Spicer, so maybe that's what we should be doing with our free time for laughs.
Let's hope so. Let's hope there's more laughs from Saturday Night Live than there was from Snatched.
Whitney Seibold contributes to Crave Online. Thanks for coming in.
Of course.